This program is called Peace Talks. It's every Tuesday from 3 to 5. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're discussing today one of the topics we'll be talking about is the situation in the Congo, in particular, how it is affecting women. And right now there's a war taking place in the Congo, and more people have died there than in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Darfur combined, yet we don't hear very much about it. Joining me to discuss this right now is Annika van Woudenberg. She's a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, based in the Congo. Hello, Annika.
Hello.
Hi, thanks so much for joining me today. Really appreciate it. It's quite late where you are, and you're currently in London, is that right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we can start off, if you can just give us kind of an overview of the human rights situation in the Congo at the moment.
Well, I've just come back from Eastern Congo last week, and of course, although Congo had historic elections in 2006, this country has not yet turned a corner, and it continues to be really a human rights crisis. More than 5 million people have died in Congo since 1998, and that makes this the most deadly war in the world today. But it's not just a matter of people dying, which is, of course, also horrible, and not all of those people are dying due to direct violence, but certainly a percentage of them are doing so. But it's also a situation where tens of thousands of women have been raped, where people are tortured on a pretty systematic basis, where they're forced to flee their homes. And I think there's probably, Congo registers as one of those places in the world which is probably one of the nastier places to live at the moment. And certainly from my perspective, it continues to be a human rights crisis.
So you say that 5 million people have died there since 1998. What is the main driving force behind this huge number of people that are being slain there? What are the main causes?
Well, this, of course, was a country that was at war officially from 1998 to 2003, although basically since 2003, fighting has continued in the eastern parts of the Congo. And this was Africa's first world war. It drew in, at the height of the war, 9 other countries, neighboring countries, as well as other countries in Africa. And in part, they were fighting over Congo's natural resources. This is a country that is rich in diamonds, gold, copper, cobalt, coltan, which is one of those very precious minerals that's in our mobile phones and in our laptop computers. And that certainly has been one of the driving factors behind the war. It's not been the only reason why the fighting has continued. I think it's, of course, also worth pointing out that this is largely a non-functioning state where the army has become a predator on the people rather than a force that is supposed to protect its citizens. And the unprofessionalism of the army and the growing number of rebel groups and armed groups has indeed made this a very, very dangerous country.
So who is committing, you say that rape has been used as a weapon of war there, and in a major way, who is committing most of these rapes?
Well, that's a very interesting one to analyze, because part of the problem here is that statistics are always incredibly difficult in Congo. This is not a place where you can do systematic analysis of statistics, so it's kind of hard to be 100% precise. But basically, one of the biggest abusers against women is the Congolese army itself. But also nearly all of the rebel groups and armed militias that have been fighting in eastern Congo, all of them have committed rape. All of them use rape as a weapon of war. And I should add that one of those groups includes Rwandan Hutu militias. And these are the individuals who, some of whom are responsible for the genocide in Rwanda, who crossed the border into Congo in 1994 and who have remained in the forests of eastern Congo for the past 14 years. And that group, known today as the FDLR, have also carried out serious abuses against Congolese civilians. I think in a nutshell, it's fair to say that everywhere you turn, wherever there's a man with a gun, they tend to prey on the population and specifically on women and girls.
Are civilians committing any of these rapes because things have become so chaotic and really there's no enforcement, is my understanding. There's nobody going after these people.
Well, it's been an interesting issue to follow in Congo because, indeed, increasingly we do see that civilians are also perpetrators of rape. What I think is the distinction between a man with a gun carrying out rape who is part of a militia group and a civilian, or let's say the man next door, is that civilians, of course, don't perpetrate this as a weapon of war. This is people using a state of lawlessness, the fact that the justice system doesn't work, to prey on women who live in their neighborhood and in their society. But the issue of rape is a tough one to understand on occasion. I think it is clear to say that this is a society and a community where they have suffered and witnessed some immense atrocities, and that has had an impact on the immediate family, on communities in general, and on the society as a whole. And I think there are an awful lot of traumatized people in Congo, and people who've suffered that kind of trauma will use different outlets for it. And I think that's potentially one of the reasons why we are seeing rape by civilians also on the increase.
You were recently on 60 Minutes discussing this issue, and one of the things that you said is that the justice system is on its knees in the Congo, and that you can count on one hand the number of cases that you're aware of that have been brought to trial, and that people get away with rape, they get away with murder, and that the chances of being arrested are nil. Is that still currently the situation?
I'm afraid that it is. It really is one of the shocking realities in Congo, is that you can get away with murder. The chances of being held to account, of being arrested, are almost nil. It's the shocking reality, and it's something we desperately need to do something about. I think one of the things that we have seen in Congo is that the awareness about the scale of rape against women and girls has increased dramatically over the years. I remember when Human Rights Watch first started to highlight this issue back in 2002, very few people were aware about it, and women just were scared to talk about it. And that has changed quite dramatically over the past few years. I think we can no longer say that people are unaware. Certainly the officials in Congo, the UN officials, government officials, policymakers, they are aware of the scale of the problem now. What we're not seeing is an end to it. What we're not seeing are men being held to account for it. And specifically what we're not seeing is senior commanders, army generals, army colonels, the leaders of the militia groups, none of them are being held to account for it. So it's a culture of impunity, and people think it's okay to continue doing this. And I think it's high time we tackle the deterrent factor. It's high time we see justice for this crime.
If it's senior military officials, some of whom are responsible for these mass rapes, and they're not being held accountable, is that because the government doesn't want to punish its own, essentially?
In part, it's that. The government has pursued a strategy of integrating militia leaders and rebel leaders into the national army. So, in effect, they reward the killers and the rapists rather than holding them to account. So, in some ways, it's no surprise that we see this army as an unprofessional army of individuals who have a track record of these kinds of human rights abuses. And I think the only way to start tackling this is to start holding trials, to start carrying out investigations where the more senior leaders will be held to account. The few cases that I do know have occurred in Congo where they've arrested individuals responsible for rape have largely been at the middle and lower ranks of either the militia groups or of the army. So the senior individuals get off the hook, and it's really time that a message is sent that this culture of impunity needs to come to an end.
What was the kind of pressure, or what was brought to bear that made them even go after middle level people? Why did they pursue anyone if there's a culture of impunity?
On the cases that I'm aware of, where we have seen these cases, it has been because of two factors. One is the pressure from the United Nations. And when the United Nations provides assistance to put on a case and to help the judges and the magistrates and to help the witnesses come forward, on those few cases where that has happened, we have seen that the courts actually start proceedings. The second is when local NGOs and international NGOs really push the case and make it a big issue in the press, scream about it, shout about it, put on a lot of pressure, then on occasion we see them react. But that takes a huge amount of effort. And of course, that cannot be done in every single case. There are just so many of them.
So you say this needs to be brought to light. You say that it needs to be put to a stop, that there needs to be real investigations, and that, you know, there can't be this culture of impunity anymore. What can be done about it? What could change that?
I think it's the need to start somewhere. Recently, the United Nations, some of the groups of the United Nations, have decided to start a pilot project whereby they specifically set up a couple of teams that includes magistrates and judges with some international assistance to try cases of rape. I think that's a really innovative and important way forward, and we need to watch how those pilot cases go over the next couple of months and hopefully see that roll out further across the country. But really what it needs is a number of high-profile cases. It doesn't have to be hundreds. We can start small. We can start with 5 or 6 or 7, but cases where senior individuals are going to be held to account. And that takes political will. It takes money. It takes pressure from civil society, from groups like Human Rights Watch, and from others. And we're certainly working on that, and I think the women themselves are working on that. When I was in Congo just last week, I had a meeting with a number of these women groups who work on these issues. And, you know, they face an uphill battle every single day when they try and bring a case. And usually what happens is a woman will go to the local prosecutor or the local magistrate to say, I've been raped. And the first thing he does is he asks her for money. Give me $50 and I will register your case. And the minimal rate that they ask for is $10. And it goes up depending on whether they believe that the individual has a bit of money. And in part, they do this because they don't get paid. They don't have salaries. So there needs to be support to the justice system. There needs to be a witness protection program for women who come forward and support for them when they bring these cases. And there needs to be political will to make this happen.
You've said that, you know, part of what is driving the war there and the conflict there has been going on for years now, and the resulting 5 million deaths and all of these, you know, women being raped and it's being used as a weapon of war, etc., is partly driven by resources in the Congo, minerals, metals, different things, some of which are used in cell phones that are made in the, you know, a lot used in the West and the U.S. What kind of role do folks here in the U.S. and people in Europe and other, you know, quote-unquote, developed countries that are using many of the things that come from the Congo, what kind of role do they play? What kind of responsibility do we have to what's happening there?
Well, that for me has always been the important part about what's going on in Congo, because Congo is a supplier of many raw materials for goods that we purchase in Europe and in the United States and elsewhere. And I think we need to start becoming more conscientious consumers. We need to ask the question when we go and we buy a gold ring, when we go and we buy a diamond, when we pick up the mobile phone, the latest version that we want to buy, we need to ask the question, where are the raw goods coming from? Where has this gold come from? Where has the diamond come from? We need to ensure that the stores from which we buy such goods ask the question up the supply line. And I think we as consumers have huge power to do that. It's when we as consumers start asking questions that the retail outlets will start asking questions of their suppliers, that those suppliers will ask questions of their suppliers, and so the chain goes on. But we have to be aware that in a globalized society where the products that we buy can come from just about anywhere now, we have a responsibility to know what we're purchasing. We have a responsibility to ask the question. I don't think that means we're going to automatically get the answer. I don't think every retailer knows where the coltan in the latest Nokia phone, for instance, would come from, or whatever phone it is that we're picking up. But unless we as consumers start to put pressure on that they do know that, that we start to get responsible business, business that contributes to development of a country and not to increased human rights abuses, I think that's what's going to make a change.
And what kind of position, if maybe you're, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but is there an official position that the U.S. government has taken on the Congo, and what has been U.S. government foreign policy towards the Congo?
Well, the policy, as always with governments, has changed over time, and I've been working on Congo for more than 9 years, and I've certainly seen kind of shifts within the American policy towards Congo. The most recent one has actually been a very positive development. In August, September of last year, there appeared to be an awakening in the State Department in Washington that actually the situation in Congo was not getting any better, and that they really needed to use the influence and the pressure of the United States to bring about peace in eastern Congo, and specifically to look at some of the issues around sexual violence. And we have seen, I certainly have witnessed myself, much more active engagement by the U.S. government in the past few months, which has actually been very positive. The U.S. government has attempted to facilitate discussions between one of the key rebel leaders in eastern Congo, a dissident general called Laurent Kunda, and the government in Kinshasa. And that led in January to an important milestone, which was the signing of a peace agreement between the rebel leader and the Congolese government. And largely that was due to the influence of the United States and of the European Union.
And do you
think...
Go ahead.
So I would say that there has been some positive developments there, and that the role of the U.S. has been quite critical in that respect.
And has that made a positive difference, this peace agreement that's taken place? Has it changed things on the ground?
It's early days. You know, this peace agreement is now, I think, about 3 weeks old. And it is a very important milestone for eastern Congo. I've been following eastern Congo for many years, and this is really one of the more important developments for peace that I have seen in quite some time. But look, the road ahead is going to be rocky. This is not going to be the major turning point. I think there will probably need to be a host of such milestones. And I don't think that the road ahead is smooth. But there needed to be a ceasefire between the rebel group and the government. That has now been achieved. And if that ceasefire can hold, if the United States and other key international players like the European Union can continue to remain involved, then I'm hopeful that we are on the start of a process towards peace. But look, this is not going to be an easy road ahead.
You said in 2003 that historic elections were held there in the Congo?
The elections were held in 2006, so 2003 is officially when the war ended.
I see.
And a transitional government was put into place in Congo for 3 years as it prepared for elections.
I see.
And 2006 were the first democratic elections in more than 40 years.
How democratic were those elections? I remember there was a lot of questions about whether or not they were free and fair. Do you know much about that?
Well, I believe on the day of the vote, things went relatively well. In fact, remarkably smoothly. There was hardly any violence at all during the different... there were two different days of voting that took place. But I think we have seen, we saw significant violence after the vote. In fact, in the capital, Kinshasa, a few months after the president had won the elections, President Joseph Kabila, who was president during the transition and became the front runner and, in fact, won the elections in 2006. What we then saw was some very worrying developments during the first 12 months of this new government. And we are 1 year on now from the government having been installed, and we have seen some very repressive acts against journalists, against opposition members, basically against people who have different opinions than the current government as to how the country should develop. And I think those are troubling signs. Democracy is not built on elections alone. One democratic election does not bring democracy. And it's very important that the international community and the Congolese themselves do hold their government to account and demand greater freedoms and the opportunity to speak out when they're not happy with what their government is doing.
I'm speaking with Annika van Woudenberg. She is the senior Congo researcher at Human Rights Watch. We're talking about the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where about 5 million people have died in a war that's been going on since the late 90s. And this is more people than have died in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Darfur combined. And yet we don't hear much about the situation in the Congo, so I wanted to discuss it today. I want to talk a little bit more about what role things like coltan and other, there's different kinds of resources that come out of the Congo that are very valuable, metals and minerals and things. What kind of role that's played in this war? Is that a big part of it? Are people fighting over these resources? And we talked a little bit about how people can make, you know, connections between the cell phone they're buying and the coltan that's coming from possibly from the Congo. Would you suggest that people boycott products that are, you know, coming if we know that the source is from the Congo? So just what can people do and what role does that play?
Well, I think it's sometimes too easy to be able to boycott products. The difficulty, I think, in a globalized economy is that it's very difficult to trace exactly where these kind of minerals come from. And I'll perhaps just provide an example of some research that Human Rights Watch did on the issue of gold. Because one of the things that I myself investigated was in a particular corner of Congo called Ituri, which is in northeastern Congo, where one of Africa's largest unexplored gold fields exists. And what we discovered early on in the conflict in this particular corner of Congo is that armed groups were fighting for control of the gold. Because if you were sitting on a gold mine, you were able to turn the gold into money. Money allowed you to buy power and guns. And warlords very quickly conned on to how important gold was for the future of their armed group. And we decided we would trace where this gold goes to figure out how it enters global gold markets, and to try and find a way to cut off the financing link to these murderous armed groups. And what we discovered was, you know, that the gold took sometimes a very roundabout route, sometimes a very direct route, but it crossed the border from Congo into Uganda, and then indeed went from Uganda directly on to Switzerland, at least the bulk of the gold. And this was a market roughly of $60 million a year. And when we exposed this, the companies in Switzerland that were purchasing that gold very quickly actually decided to stop using those clients. And then what happened was the trade moved to Dubai. So what we see is that although you can close off perhaps one route, these things will then find other routes. They will be able to find markets. And I think what's more important is to start to get companies, no matter where they are based, whether it's Dubai or Switzerland or the United States, to be much more careful about where they source their goods and to start putting in place basic requirements. But that means all companies have to do that, because unless you get general regulations across the board, there will always be someplace else that these warlords can go.
I want to talk a little bit more about the situation for women in the Congo. You said this is one of the most deadly conflicts, or the most deadly conflict on the planet today, and that women are kind of, you know, facing the brunt of this violence there. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about, we've talked about how rape is used as a weapon of war, and I know that it's, you know, maybe not something most people want to talk about or hear about, but my understanding is that these rapes are particularly brutal. Rape is always brutal, but there is some disfiguring that goes on often. I'm wondering if you could just give us some more detail on what these women are facing.
Yeah, it is. It is indeed one of the curses of Congo that the women suffer in the ways that they do. We have documented a variety of different tactics that appear to be used by armed groups in Congo. One of the tactics that they use, which is why we've qualified it as a weapon of war, is that they use it as a way to terrorize people, civilians, villages, communities into accepting their control or into punishing them for controlling the enemy. And one of the things that we saw, for instance, was let's take one particular village, the village of Shabunda, the town, actually. Shabunda is a town, where when one of the rebel groups, the Mai Mai group, came in and retook the town, they brought a whole number of women into the central square of the town and then raped them publicly. Numerous soldiers raped each woman. This was gang rape of countless women in public, in front of their families, in front of their children, in order to show who was boss, in order to show we are the new group in town, we will be the ones in control, we are the ones who you now need to listen to. And we see that in village after village, town after town. They don't just rape the women. Frequently, they insert other objects into the women's vagina, perhaps their gun, a stick, a branch. Frequently, these rapes are so brutal that women suffer massive fistulas, which is one of the problems that women have suffered in Congo, but also other medical side effects of having been raped so brutally. And indeed, this was on such a large scale that the women's movement, together with some of the policymakers in Congo, decided to change the rape law in Congo. Because actually, according to the old law, inserting an object in a woman's vagina was not considered as rape. So using a stick or a gun did not qualify as rape. And under the new law that was passed in Congo in 2003, it now does. But these are the kind of things that we see day after day, year after year, and it hasn't stopped. It still goes on today.
I've heard stories of broken bottles, knives, women being shot there, and being incontinent for the rest of their lives because of this, or you know, if they survive it. So what happens to these women after these horrible gang rapes and other disfigurement that goes on, and where do they go for help? If the justice system isn't going to help them, especially if they don't have a bribe for to even have it investigated, where are they turning? What are they doing after this?
Well, the first thing, of course, is it depends whether a woman needs medical support after the rape. And, of course, many of them do. And there are now two phenomenal hospitals, one that operates in the town in North Kivu and another one in South Kivu. These are the eastern provinces of Congo. Two phenomenal hospitals with the most courageous doctors and nurses who are now trying to fix these women, who are providing them with surgery in order to try and patch them back up together. But, of course, the ones who make it to the hospitals are the lucky few. We know that they are the tip of the iceberg. For many women, they are in isolated villages. They don't have the money or the possibilities to even come to the larger towns to seek medical treatment. And we know many suffer in silence. For a large number of women, they've also frequently been kicked out of the home. If the husband knows that the woman has been raped, and of course, especially if it's been done publicly or it's been done in front of other members of the family, they do know that. And thousands of women have been ejected out of their homes and hence live even more difficult lives because either now they're single mothers or they've been cut off from their husband and their children. And we know that many, many women get no support at all because in the villages, in the remote areas, there is no support.
Why are their husbands abandoning them after this horrible violence was done to them?
Frequently, they're considered sullied goods, dirty, used and abused, and so they are thrown out of the home for that reason. Sometimes it's because, of course, the husbands fear that the women will have picked up HIV/AIDS or other diseases that they will then now get from their wives. In the early years of the war, we saw this on a huge scale. There have now been programs to try and educate the men about this, to try and educate families that it's not the woman's fault, that chucking them out of the home, abandoning them, is actually not the right way to go. And we're starting to see some impact of that. But again, it's the fortunate few who have the husbands who will accept them back. I would still say the majority are not accepted back in the home after the rape, if the husband knows that the woman has been raped, which is also why, of course, many women don't talk about it.
Are all sides committing these violent, horrible rapes and this disfigurement? Is it the rebels and government forces and even some civilians? Is it pretty much everyone on all sides of the conflicts, on the conflict, that's committing these acts?
Certainly all armed groups that operate in eastern Congo have committed rape in that very violent manner. We've carried out a lot of research over the years on that, and there are no clean groups on this, if we can put it that way. All armed groups bear a responsibility for using rape as a weapon of war and for using incredibly violent means to rape women and girls. And remember that this can sometimes be girls, in fact, children as young as 2 years old, up to elderly women in their 70s. We have documented cases along that entire scale of the age group.
Wow. So they're not drawing the line pretty much anywhere, huh? What is it that people can do about this if they're here or, you know, and that we're so far away from the situation? And is there anything we could directly do, say, send some financial assistance to these hospitals that are helping the women? Or is there some classes that some of the women are able to get an education and then maybe take that knowledge and start on their own with maybe a small business? Or is there any programs that people hear, something tangible people can do? Is there something we should be calling on our government to do? Maybe you have some suggestions of how people might respond, because hearing this information can be not only incredibly troubling, of course, but also disempowering in a way, like, wow, that's horrible. Now what do I do, you know?
Well, I guess I would say all of the above, because certainly there are some phenomenal women's groups and programs in eastern Congo set up to try and assist the victims of rape. And there are many different places to go for that. But certainly providing money and assistance is always one of the ways, I think, that we can help. But the other thing is, I think, indeed, raising the issue to congressmen, to senators, because we do see that the United States government has, in part, changed their policy on issues of rape and sexual violence, putting more money from USAID into such projects because legislators in Washington are making noise about this. And they're making noise because they're hearing it from people back in the various different constituencies that they represent. And I think it is important to make noise about that, I think especially as women. So I think we have to stand shoulder to shoulder with our Congolese sisters. There shouldn't be any place in the world where this kind of thing is taking place. And when it happens, we should be shocked. I'm frequently shocked. And, you know, I've been working on this for 9 years, and there are still stories that I hear, women whose testimonies I take, where I just want to scream and shout because it's not right that this is happening. And I think we have to stand with our Congolese sisters to say, we want an end to this. The key thing I think we need to push is, we want to see justice for this. This isn't just about raising awareness. That's part of the battle. But I think now we need to say to our legislators, we need to say to the Congolese government, we want justice for this. Those individuals responsible need to be held to account. And until they're held to account, this is going to continue. And it's time a stop is put to it. So I think messages going to congressmen and women and to senators should be about the need for justice for this particular crime, the need to start holding perpetrators to account.
And that would be, they would be held to account through the Congolese government, through the court system in the Congo? Is that how they would be held to account?
Well, Yeah, today there are two possibilities. One is the International Criminal Court, of which, of course, the United States has not been a big supporter. So certainly that's always another thing that listeners can do, is to start to influence their legislators to support the International Criminal Court, who are carrying out investigations in the Democratic Republic of Congo, who have now arrested three warlords. In fact, the third one was arrested last week, and one of the charges against him is for crimes of sexual violence, and specifically sexual enslavement. So the International Criminal Court is one avenue we can use to start holding perpetrators to account.
They've literally arrested these warlords?
Yes, so three of them are now in Holland, in The Hague, which is the seat of the International Criminal Court. And of the three, two have been charged with a range of crimes, including murder, massacres, torture, use of child soldiers, but also crimes of sexual violence.
And they arrested them in the Congo?
Exactly, yes.
And how does the Congolese government react to that? Do they turn a blind eye to it?
In fact, for the International Criminal Court, the Congolese government has been cooperative. They indeed first asked the International Criminal Court to help them to carry out investigations. But the reality of the International Criminal Court is that they go after those who bear the greatest responsibility. They're not going to arrest all of these individuals. They're going to take a handful of people and hold them to account in international tribunals, and in this particular case, in The Hague. And if we're really going to put an end to this, the real place where people need to be held to account is in Congo. And that means more money, support, again, political will in Congo, and by international donors like the donors from the United States, to start to put a greater emphasis on support to the justice system, and specifically that we want to see trials for crimes of rape.
I've been speaking with Annika van Woudenberg. She is the senior Congo researcher at Human Rights Watch. We've been talking about the conflict in Congo and focusing on the situation for women there. I just want to thank you very much for joining me, even though it's late at night where you are in London, to discuss this very important issue. And I want to give you the opportunity to make just a final comment, if that's simply to point people where they can get more information, or if you want to wrap up your thoughts and then give us a website or two, whatever you want to say.
Well, I guess what I would say is I think probably many listeners rarely see Congo on the front pages of the newspapers, probably hardly ever. And I think it is our responsibility to become informed about what's happening in the deadliest war in the world today. And as you've been saying, that's not Iraq or Darfur or Afghanistan. It's the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I think people need to become more informed about what's happening and to start to make noise about that. And certainly on the Human Rights Watch website, we have lots of information about what's been going on in Congo, about the abuses being committed, and we have done a couple of groundbreaking reports specifically on this issue of rape. So I guess I'd like to leave your listeners just to encourage everyone to find out more information, to make some noise, to write to congressmen, to senators, to say that you care about what's going on in Congo and you want to see the United States doing more. Because I can tell you from having worked for 9 years in that country, when people in the United States make noise, people in Congo listen.
Thank you so much, Annika. Thank you for joining me today. Take care. Again, that was Annika van Woudenberg, senior Congo researcher at Human Rights Watch. She suggested to go to their website, a couple of groundbreaking reports there on this issue. And you can go to their website at hrw.org. That stands for Human Rights Watch, hrw.org. And what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to play a clip from 60 Minutes. It's a 12-minute piece that came out in early January. Annika van Woudenberg is one of the folks they had on the program. So I'm going to go ahead and play that for you now. I want to warn people that this is very disturbing, so just be prepared for that. And at the end, I'll give out some info again where you can get more information. So we're going to see if we can play this and actually hear it. Yes, this is mainstream, but
And now, CNN's Anderson Cooper on assignment for 60 Minutes.
There's some good information in it.
Right now, there's a war taking place in the heart of Africa, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And more people have died there than in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Darfur combined. You probably haven't heard much about it, but it is the deadliest conflict since World War II. Within the last 10 years, more than 4 million people have died, and the numbers keep rising. As we found when we went there a few months ago, the most frequent targets of this hidden war are women. It is, in fact, a war against women. And the weapon used to destroy them, their families, and whole communities is rape. We want to warn you, some of what you'll see and hear in this report is disturbing. So 6 women were attacked on Friday. Dr. Dennis Mukwege is the director of the Panzi Hospital in eastern Congo. In this war against women, his hospital is the front line.
So one of them are here.
One of the latest victims is Sifa Mikatambala. She was raped 2 days ago by soldiers who raided her village.
They just cut her at many places.
With a machete?
Yeah.
Sifa was pregnant, but that didn't stop her rapists.
They even cut her at her genitals.
Yeah.
In the last 10 years in Congo, hundreds of thousands of women have been raped, most of them gang raped. The hospital is full of them.
All these women have been raped?
Yeah.
They've all been patients of yours?
Within a week, Dr. Mukwege says this room will be filled with new faces, new victims.
You know, they're in deep pain, but it's not just physical pain. It's psychological pain that you can see. Here at the hospital, we've seen women who've stopped living.
Are all the people you treat adults?
No. There are children. I think the youngest was 3 years old.
3 years old?
And the oldest was 75.
To understand what's happening here, you have to go back more than a decade. When the genocide that claimed nearly a million lives in neighboring Rwanda spilled over into Congo. Since then, the Congolese army, foreign-backed rebels, and homegrown militias have been fighting each other over power and this land, which has some of the world's biggest deposits of gold, copper, diamonds, and tin. The United Nations was called in, and today their mission is the largest peacekeeping operation in history.
Since 2005, some 17,000 UN troops and personnel have cobbled together a fragile peace. Last year, they oversaw the first democratic election in this country in 40 years. But now all that they've accomplished is at risk. Fighting has broken out once again here in eastern Congo, and the region threatens to slip into all-out war.
Each new battle is followed by pillaging and rape. Entire communities are terrorized. Forced to flee their homes, people take whatever they can and walk for miles in the desperate hope of finding food and shelter. Over the last year, more than 500,000 people have been uprooted. A fraction of them make it to these cramped camps where they depend on UN aid to survive.
This camp sprang up just 2 months ago. It's already overcrowded, but more people keep arriving. They come here seeking refuge, a safe haven, but the truth is, in Congo, for women, there's no such thing. Even in these supposedly protected camps, women are raped every single day.
Has rape almost become the norm here?
I think because of the widespread nature of the war, because there has been so much violence, rape is now on a daily basis, rape is the norm.
Annika van Woudenberg is the senior Congo researcher at Human Rights Watch.
Women get raped in wars all the time. How is it different here?
I think what's different in Congo is the scale and the systematic nature of it. Indeed, as well, the brutality. This is not rape because soldiers have got bored and have nothing to do. It is a way to ensure that communities accept the power and authority of that particular armed group. This is about showing terror. This is about using it as a weapon of war.
It's hard to imagine this war happening in the midst of such breathtaking beauty and abundance. But after decades of dictatorship and corruption, this country is broken. Most of the fighting and the raping takes place in remote areas difficult to get to.
We're heading to a place called Walungu. It's an isolated village in the mountains of eastern Congo. For years, there have been armed groups fighting in this region. Thousands of men who emerge from the forest to terrorize villages and steal women. Congo's government seems unable or unwilling to stop them. In the last week alone, there have been three attacks in which women have been raped. The youngest victim was just 6 years old. In some villages, as many as 90% of the women have been raped. Men in the villages are usually unarmed and incapable of fighting back. In Walungu, we found 24-year-old Lucien Moroihi. She was at home one night with her two children and her younger brother when six soldiers broke in. They tied her up and began to rape her one by one.
I was lying on the ground, and they gave a flashlight to my younger brother so that he could see them raping me.
They were telling your brother to hold the flashlight?
Yes. They raped me like they were animals, one after another. When the first one finished, they washed me out with water, told me to stand up so the next man could rape me.
She was convinced they'd kill her, just as soldiers had murdered her parents the year before. Instead, they turned to her brother.
They wanted him to rape me, but he refused and told them, I cannot do such a thing. I cannot rape my sister. So they took out their knives and stabbed him to death in front of me.
Lucien was then dragged through the forest to the soldiers' camp. She was forced to become their slave and was raped every day for 8 months. All the while, she had no idea where her children were.
Did you know if they were alive or dead?
I was thinking that they had been killed. I didn't think I would find them alive.
Finally, Lucienne escaped. Back in her village, she found her two little girls were alive. But she also learned that she was pregnant. She was carrying the child of one of her rapists. Lucien's husband abandoned her, and that happens to rape survivors all over Congo.
I used to think that when men fled, they were irresponsible. But now I understand things differently. They haven't fled because their wives have been raped, but because they feel they've been raped. They have been traumatized because they couldn't fight back, humiliated, because they weren't able to do anything to protect their wives and children.
When a woman is raped, it's not just her that's raped, it's the entire community that's destroyed.
What is the program? Judith Registre is with an organization called Women for Women. They run support groups for survivors of rape.
When they take a woman to rape her, they'll line up the family, they'll line up other members of the communities to actually witness that.
They make them watch.
They make them watch. And so what that means for that particular woman when it's all over is that total shame personally to have been witnessed by so many people as she's being violated.
Many of the women in Dr. Mukwege's hospital are not only blamed for what happened to them, they're shunned because of fears they've contracted HIV, and shunned because their rapes were so violent they can no longer control their bodily functions.
So you're doing about five surgeries a day?
Yeah.
Dr. Mukwege's patients often have had objects inserted into their vaginas, broken bottles, bayonets. Some women have even been shot between the legs by their rapists.
Why would somebody do that? Why would somebody shoot a woman inside?
In the beginning, I was asking myself the same question. This is a show of force, of power. It's done to destroy the person. Sex is being used to commit evil. People flee, they become refugees. They can't get help. They become malnourished, and it's disease which finishes them off.
For these women, Dr. Mukwege is both healer and counselor. Dunia Karani is an orphan. She has polio and can't walk, but that didn't stop soldiers from raping her. Now she's pregnant and has no idea how she'll cope.
What do you say to a young girl? What do you tell her about her future?
The most difficult thing is when there is nothing I can do. When I see a 16-year-old, a pretty 16-year-old who's had everything destroyed, and I tell her that I have to give her a colostomy bag, that is difficult.
Despite those difficulties, more often than not, Dr. Mukwege is able to repair the damage to these women's bodies. They see him as a miracle worker, one of the only men they can trust.
She's very happy.
This gives you hope.
Yeah.
It gives you strength to continue.
Yeah.
Strength is something few women in Congo lack. They bear the burdens, farm the fields, and hold the families together. Yet nothing, it seems, is being done to protect them. The war is so widespread that rapes are increasingly being committed by civilians. A few washed-out billboards tell men that rape is wrong, but there's little evidence Congolese officials take the problem seriously. In the prosecutor's office, the complaints pile up. We were told a $10 bribe could get a rape accusation investigated, but few cases ever go to court. We asked the prosecutor to show us the prison to see how many rapists were actually behind bars. But when we got there, we were in for a surprise. The prison had no fences, and the guards had been kicked out. The inmates had taken over the asylum.
The fact is, the justice system is on its knees in Congo. I can count on one hand the number of cases that we're aware of that have been brought to trial. Literally here, people get away with rape, they get away with murder. The chances of being arrested are nil.
There may be no justice here, but there are organizations trying to help rape survivors get back on their feet. Women for Women teaches survivors how to make soap, how to cook, skills they can use to earn money. They also learn how to read and write. It is the first time many of these women have ever been in a classroom. It is their chance for a whole new life. Remember Lucien Moroihi? She's jumped at that chance. She hopes to start her own business one day. And that little child she holds, that's the child of one of the soldiers who raped her, one of the men who killed her brother. A baby girl, born a year ago. A baby girl Lucien named Luck.
I named her Luck because I went through many hardships. I could have been killed in the forest, but I got my life back. I have hope.
Hope is not something you'd expect Congo's rape survivors to still cling to, but they do. Each morning in Panzi Hospital, they gather to raise their voices. Our sufferings on earth, they sing, will be relieved in heaven. Relief in Congo, it seems, is just too much to ask for.
That was, again, a clip from a 60 Minutes piece on the situation in the Congo. And, I played that even though it's mainstream because I think that it is a pretty fair piece, and I also think that it gives some opportunity for people to actually hear some voices of women there who have experienced some of this, some of these horrible attacks. And in any case, I want to let folks know where you can go to get more information and support some of these women. One excellent site is womenforwomen.org. That is the site for Women for Women International. And on the homepage there, womenforwomen.org, you can click on the left-hand side of the screen. There is an image of a woman, and it says the Women of Democratic Republic of Congo. And you can click on that. It'll take you to a page where you can see that 60 Minutes piece, you can sponsor a woman, and you can read about the type of work that Women for Women International is doing there and how you can support it. I'm not sure if you can support the hospitals through that website, but the name of the hospital, the director they were interviewing there, the name of that hospital is Panzi Hospital in the Eastern Congo. Panzi Hospital has a website. It's Panzi Hospital. Bukavu.org, that's spelled P-A-N-Z-I, hospital, B-U-K-A-V-U. But if you just put P-A-N-Z-I, Panzi Hospital, into Google or search engine, you'll come up with the website for this hospital. I understand that they do take donations, and one of the things that they're doing there is helping to rebuild women who've been disfigured. And hopefully find a way that they can at least live a somewhat normal life from here on out. Not sure about psychological counseling. I would guess they're providing that as well. But in any case, you can go to their website at pansyhospitalbukavu.org. And you can also check out womenforwomen.org and Human Rights Watch website, hrw.org, to learn more about what's going on in the Congo and what you can do to help.